Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, Rail 21. We were talking about the night duty you had as a senior NCO on duty. What were you watching out for? That's what it went off while you were describing.
It was just basically to make sure that there was no horseplay, as young men tended to get up to make sure that there was no bullying, which I'm pleased to say there never was any bullying. And if you just kept walking around showing yourself to make sure they knew you were there. And if I used to have a thing about ablutions. If I walked into ablutions, I thought they were a bit filthy. I'd been used quite a lot that day. Then I would get a couple of chaps in and say, right, get this place cleaned up properly. So that the guys in the morning went up to say, a mammoth task and things like that. Then at 6 o'clock the next morning, you were on from 8 o'clock in the evening till 6 o'clock in the morning. You started around about 10 to 6, kicking ass, getting them out of bed. And once you were satisfied they were all up and then shows were sparking, then you went back home and got ready for parade. But you slept. I mean, I think lights were out about 11 o'clock. Once the lights were out, you went around and checked all the lights were out. Then you got your head down as well.
When they finished the 10 weeks, you wouldn't see them again. When they were doing their specialist training, you wouldn't see them.
Oh, yeah, you would see them because within the confines of the...
But you wouldn't be in charge of it.
Well, I wouldn't be in charge of them. No, they would go to another company.
And that's where they get their driving training, accountancy or whatever,
yeah,
clerking.
Yeah, that's right, clerking and signals training. Now, part of the training staff also were civilians. We had the civilians teach them how to drive, teach them how to signal, mainly all ex-servicemen, RAF and Army types. But we also had a big staff, of military staff as well. And it was a very, very efficient setup. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Now, were you there when... Weren't the Cameronians disbanded while you were there? I'm not sure...
While I was there... I was tend to give a lecture one night. I'd still about 2 years to go in the army yet, or maybe less. But I went in one night to this lecture room to give a lecture, and one of the young men said, "Oh, sorry to hear about your regiment, Sergeant." I said, "What?" He said, "Sorry to hear about your regiment." I said, "What about my regiment?" He said, "Oh, it's been disbanded." And I thought he was taking the mickey. And one of the lads said, "Quick," he said, the Scottish news will be on the television in a moment, sir, so why don't you switch it on? Switch it on there. It was his first item on the Scottish news that night. And I'm afraid I wasn't a very happy man, really. Although I'd made one or two enemies in the regiment, I didn't want to see the regiment going. No way. Because I'd also had a lot of happy memories of it. However, that was the start of it. And as it happened, just shortly after that, we finished that 10-week training, and then I decided, my wife and I had by this time decided that I wanted to stay in Ayrshire. We'd settle down in Ayrshire. So towards that end, I went up to Ayr County Council and asked put my name in for a house. Actually, I'd only be 18 months to do by this time, and asked if could give me a house. So the gentleman there said, "Well," he said, "the only house we've got at the moment that you could walk into is about 30 miles away from here." He said, "It's a little place called Glen Buck." I said, "Glen Buck?" I said, "That rings a bell somewhere." "Yeah," I said, "there's the keys." He gave me the keys. He said, "You and your family go out and have a look at it," he said. So that when I finished that 10 weeks, my wife and I went out to this place, Glen Buck, and it was right out in the Wells of Wanney. It was right out in the Wells. It was an old village that had virtually collapsed about itself. And there was all it consisted of was a football field, a dilapidated church, and two blocks of council houses, 8 houses in all. So we had a look around this place. And I said to my wife, "What do you fancy?" She said, "I think I would like it here." The nearest village was 4 miles away. So I think I would like it out here. She said, "I think would do hell in the world if we'd do. My daughter, this time she was getting on. So anyway, we decided Glenn Bucket would be. So I immediately, we made arrangements for me to move the family, gave up the married quarter, and I moved into single accommodation in the sergeant's mess. And it was no great big loss, really, because I could still go home at weekends. I managed to get home. When the parade was finished on a Saturday, I would arrange that my second sergeant would do the church parade on a Sunday morning. But if there was any sport on a Sunday, I would come in and I'd stay behind and do it, like, or come in and do it. Because I had this car, and it was no problem, like, you know. So then I went back, I went into single accommodation, and spent the last 18 months in the...
Now, tell us about when you left the army. I mean, was that just... You definitely had to go. Was that your age?
Definitely, yeah. I'd done exactly 22 and a half years.
There's no option of staying on.
I suppose I could have stayed on from year to year, but I didn't fancy it. I thought, I'm getting on in life now.
And that was June 1968?
That's right, June 68. In actual fact, I was demobbed the week the regiment was disbanded, the Cameroons was disbanded. So what happened was I came in demob leave, I had a month's demob leave, and I got permission to keep my number two dress, my tartan trousers, fancy jacket, what have you, and I'd moan Glengarry, owned that myself. And on the day of the disbandment ceremony, well, we'd contacted a few friends of ours from the regiment, and on the day of the disbandment ceremony was only held about 3 miles away in Douglas. We lived in Glenbuck, and Douglas was only about 3 miles away where the regiment was raised. On that day, we jumped the car and we went, and we'd already invited about half a dozen friends to come back and have a buffet and drinks after the ceremony was finished, which happened.
And what the ceremony? So that's May, is it?
That's May. That's right. Yeah.
And what do you remember of the ceremony? Were you actually formally present or just watching?
I was just watching. You know, from
what do you remember of it?
Where. It was a very, very sad day, obviously. There was a lot of old Cameroonians turned up. The service was terrific. The ministers who took part in the service were very, very good. The turnout of the regiment was terrific. The turnout was fabulous. The drill was impeccable. And the march off was just so sad, really, to see a whole regiment marching into the distance.
You were quite emotional about it.
Back again, eh?
You were quite emotional about it.
Oh, very emotional about it, yeah, quite. As I say, I mean, on balance, I had more happy times in the regiment than I had unhappy times. And I'd made lots of great friends there, like, you know, even still to this day, whom I keep in touch with. But, well, if they're not dead, that is. But, it was a very emotional day, and we all came back to my house in Glenbuck, and Ellen had done a wonderful job, and our next-door neighbour, an old woman, she came up, and she really put the finishing touches to the whole boofy thing, like, you know, and bags of booze. And we had a wonderful night. Everybody departed about 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock that night. And that was me started. Now,
tell me about leaving the army. What actually happened? What did they do for you when you went out? Any careers, advice, anything?
Right, what happened was, I got a course, a 6 months course, as a carpenter and joiner, believe it or not. Because a civilian guy whom I met in the...
That's after you'd left the army.
After I left the army. A civilian guy whom I met in the mess, who's an honorary member of the mess, who was a wartime soldier, he'd done 5 years in the Royal Scots Fusiliers, fighting in the war. He, by this time, had set up quite a nice carpentry and joinery business. And he and I became good friends. So, when it was coming near the mob time, he said to me, "How would you like to come and work for me?" He said, "You're the type of chap," he said, "that I need in my business," because he said, "I'm not very good," he said, "at talking to people or liaison with clients and what have you, like, you know." But I said, "Joe," I said, "I don't know anything about carpentry and joinery." I said, "I haven't a clue." He said, "I can get you a 6 months course," he said. Resettlement course down in Irvine, down the river, just near where the camp was. He said, you've got a 6 months course there, he said, and then when you've learned the business, blah, blah, come work for me. However, I'm to go on this course to the town of Riven, I had to get into digs, civvy digs. And I went to this digs, who was one of the local police sergeants. His wife, Jean, ran bed and breakfast. Well, virtually full board, like, you know. Breakfast and evening meal, dinner. And I went on this course, and the accommodation was fantastic. But halfway through the course, I knew I wasn't going to make it. I could tell. I just didn't have the aptitude for it. Whilst I relished probably the other side of the guy's business, talking to clients and customers, that would have been right up my street. But I couldn't speak to people if I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, about the carpentry and joinery. Anyway, in the house was a young boarder, a young girl. I forget what she did at all, but we got chatting one night, and she was telling me that her mum and dad had a fish and chip van, but her mother was in hospital, and they'd probably have to give the fish and chip van up. She wasn't very well, like, you know. So I thought, that sounds good. So when I spoke to Ellen about it at the weekend, we said, I'd love to have a fish and chip van, Ed. She said, why not, you know? So I went down and looked at this van. They looked not bad, Nick. So anyway, I applied for and received a commutation of my pension. I got $500, it cost £500 for this van, and the goodwill of the area, like, you know. There was no point in taking it. It was miles away, down in there. It was 30 miles away. So I said to Ellen, well, bring the van up and operate here around the Muirkirk area, around the rural area here, and we'll see what we can do, you know. And to cut a long story short, we had a fabulous year, but we didn't make a tosser. We finished up broke, but we had some great fun. You know, we visited the local town, Muirkirk. It was a small country town, and they had a social club, which we used to meet there on a Friday night, Saturday night. And then we had another spot where we went, a big housing estate, we'd go there. And we loved it. It was great fun. You know, we used to have some really good laughs. Met some smashing people, like, you know. Met some horrors too, like, you know. And
but you weren't making money, so
we weren't making money.
What so next, then?
Sorry.
What next?
So I said to Ellen, look, we went to the bank. We saw a lovely sight. If we'd got the money from the bank, we could have made a go of it. But the bank wouldn't give us any money. The manager said at the time that the government, which was a Labour government then, wouldn't allow money to be given out for expansion of businesses for some reason. So anyway, I immediately then applied for the prison service.
What made you do that?
For the simple reason, I forgot to mention, by the way, that I wanted to get into the probation service. And I applied for the probation service in Ayr. And in the sergeant's mess, another great friend of mine, wonderful friend of mine, policeman, big bloke called George Cuttle. Well, when I knew him then, he was his chief detective inspector. And I was speaking to one, he was asking me what I'm going to do when I got out, like, you know. I said, I'd like to join the probation service, but I said, this chip van's come up, blah, blah, blah. Well, he said, if you ever need any help, he said, about probation service, let me know, like, you know. So when I gave the chip van up, I was made an honorary member of the mess. And one night, just shortly after I got my application put in, I met George in the mess, and I was telling him. He said, right, he said, I'll give you he said, I've known you for 5 years now. He said, I'll give you a terrific reference. But he said, I'll tell you something now, he said. You won't get to first base. I said, well, why is that? He said, they don't want army types, especially senior NCOs in the probation service. But he said, give it a whirl. So I did do. And I just had a new suit and all that, beautifully dressed, as you do in them days, immaculately dressed, to go for a job interview. And I knew as soon as I walked in, the three people sat there, a woman and two men. I could tell straight away that I was going to be bummed out. as it came to pass, I did. I went through the interview.
Why was that? You're just the wrong. They didn't want.
I just looked too military for them, and they felt that they seemed to think that that a military man was not the man for the job. That it was a softly approach they wanted. Now I could also, during the interview, I made this clear. I said, I've been dealing with young boys. I said, I've got the exact qualifications that you need. When to be strict and when to be stern and when to, you know, be a shoulder to cry on. But they wouldn't have it. So when I got back to the house, but a week later I got the letter saying that I couldn't get the job, so I said, right, prison service. I saw it advertised in the national press. I couldn't get into the Scottish service because I didn't have the height. The Scottish service was 5'8". The English service was 5'6", which I was. So I applied for it, and I got a smashing, within a week, I got all the papers back to fill in. But in the meantime, I had to earn a living. By this time, I'd given up the chip van. We'd sold it. I managed to get my money back for it, in actual fact. We sold the van, got my money back, and I said to Ellen, we've still got to earn some money. So I managed to get a job in a local brickwork.
Sticking to the prison service, so where did you go into prison?
Oh, what happened was I went for an interview to Berlini prison, and I was interviewed by a governor one and two chief officers one, Berlini prison. And out of 19 of us, there's only about 6 of us made it. Some were for different reasons. I didn't need to sit the exam because I had 5 O-levels. I'd managed to acquire 5 O-levels while I was in the army, and that got me through. I got through the medical, what have you, and then shortly after that, I got the word to report to Durham Prison, where I'd undergo a month's training at Durham Prison. And we had bachelor accommodation down there, Durham City, just near the university. Now, Durham Prison was pretty high powered. It was they held all kinds of inmates there, though.
So, just I think what we really need is a bit of a summary of your prison service, just so people know, because it's a bit out of our line, really. But although it is interesting,
it was just basically once again dealing with the human element, but in a different. Environment, totally different environment. And once again, your skills as an ex-army man was paramount.
What do you mean? What was best?
You knew the prison I went to, first of all, after I'd qualified, it was a very disciplined prison. I knew the prison officer had to apply discipline. In as much as you march prisoners about, you inspected their rooms. They were in it was an ex-RAF camp. They had to stand by their beds in the morning. So virtually, I was back in the army again. And then eventually, I was transferred to Brixton Prison in London, where I spent the last 10 years of my service in Brixton Prison.
So your military experience was very valuable, obviously.
Oh, it was very invaluable.
Now, the last thing we want to deal with, two last things. One is you learned to fly. Now, that's so unusual. And very briefly, could you just tell us about this?
Well, what happened was in Minden, David Ashley and I, Lieutenant Ashley, who was then, applied to go to the Army Air Corps. Now, as I mentioned in the training in Saltire, there was no aircraft at all. But somebody in the Army, somewhere along the line, realised that the small Army Air Corps had to be expanded. And towards this end, they put out what they call ACI, Army Council of Instruction, asking for senior NCOs or any members of the armed forces to come forward to train as aircrew. And David Ashley and I, David naturally by his rank, lieutenant, and I with my O levels, had no problem. We went and volunteered. And about 6 weeks after we volunteered, CO sent for us, and they said sorry. He told David actually he had made it all right, and he'd be posted to Middle Wallop to train. I was then marched in and told sorry, you didn't make it because you're 9 months too old. apparently the upper age limit was 30 years of age. Now it's 30 and 9 months by this time.
So what year would this be? 62?
62, 63, yeah, something in that area. So I said to the colonel, I said, well, do you think I could appeal against this? He said, by all means, he said. He said, if you're so keen, he said, appeal on your fitness and your qualifications, which I did do. And the word came back again, sorry, they blanked me out. So
you weren't to join the Army Air Corps?
Army Air Corps, yeah.
So now, why did you, tell me about learning to fly like in the...
Well, I still, after I left the Army, I was still very enthusiastic about flying. And when I was stationed in Brixton Prison, there was a young prison officer there who I spoke to one day, and he was saying to me, he was going down to Biggin Hill, the famous area, Biggin Hill Airfield, to train as a pilot. And I asked him if it would be all right to go down with him on a Saturday, which I did do. And I got a 45-minute flight with the chief flying instructor, and I was absolutely ecstatic. He gave me the controls, and that was it. I knew from then, day one, I wanted to be a pilot, really wanted to do it. And that was on a Saturday. On the Sunday morning, I reported up there and bought all the bits and pieces, the pamphlets and what have you. And I took off that morning with a Pakistani guy, a fighter pilot in the Pakistani Air Force, a guy called Islam, whom we have reason to believe shot down the president of Pakistan, eliminated him, and then hastily got out of Pakistan. Anyway, whether that's true or not, that was the story it was going about. Anyway, I did my usual training. I got there on a Saturday and a Sunday and have an hour. And then at the end of 15 hours, I managed to go solo. And then on top of that, and then later on, I transferred from that flying club. That was a civil service flying club, in actual fact. I then transferred into King Air Flying Club, where I met one of the most wonderful guys I've ever met, a young guy called Chris Angelus, who became my instructor there. And Chris was an absolute flying maniac. And he used to come to my house at nights and teach me all the subjects for the written exams. As a consequence of his tuition, and it was free, he wouldn't charge me for it. As a consequence, my results of my written exams were absolutely fantastic. I passed all the written exams with what you might say flying colours, and then I had to do an airmanship exam with the chief flying instructor, who put you through all sorts of aspects of flying, likes of stalls, spins, short field landings, emergency landings, you name it, every aspect of flying an aircraft. And I did that, and once again, passed it. Then the final part of the exam was to fly solo on a big, huge triangle. I took off from Biggin Hill and flew to Ipswich. And when you fly into, when you're on this test, you contact the air traffic control and you tell them that you're a student pilot on cross-country test. So when you and as soon as you mention that, you give your position, as soon as you mention that, they've got binoculars out and they watch every aspect of your approach to the field, your radio work, your landing, everything. And I had a form with me which the air traffic controller must fill in and give an assessment of my flying. And that was it.
Soon, I passed.
Flew to Southend to Biggin Hill, and that was it. I passed.
And what year was that, roughly?
Oh, around about 1970.
And you've flown a lot since, haven't you? Because you've got hundreds of hours in
your logbook. Nearly 800 hours in my logbook.
800?
800, yeah. I used to fly over the continent quite a lot. Where I'd get some of my mates from the prison service would fill a four-seater.
So it wasn't a commercial thing, it was a holiday, it was a hobby for you.
Private pilot, hobby.
Now, the last thing is, you are a member of the Cameronian Rifle Association. Tell us about your membership of that and what you feel that gives for you, or what you know.
It keeps all those old Cameroonians in touch. Now, there's very few of my old friends left. Like, they've all fallen off the perch. But there's still a few left. And I go up to Douglas, try and make it up to Douglas every year and meet these people. There's a sermon, what they call an annual conventicle, takes place. And then there's a social function afterwards. So you meet all the old reprobates and all the old scallywags. And it's good. And not only that, I met quite a lot of Cameroonians from a younger generation whom I've befriended. And in fact, there's one chap, an ex-National Serviceman. I'm in weekly contact with him. And that's the sort of thing. And you got there.
And you set up a plot. That's probably the best thing to finish on. Tell me why you did that and what you've done with it.
Well, about 4 years ago, I was asked by the Cameroonians Association in Scotland, would I be prepared to look after the Cameroonian regimental plot at the Field of Remembrance in Westminster Abbey? And it was just shortly after my wife died, and I thought, well, this will give me something to do. So I told the chairman, yeah, by all means. So they, through the British Legion, they brought all the stuff up to my house, crosses and all the different bits and pieces, Cameroonian cap badge and all that. And the first year I laid the plot out and represented the regiment.
How did you lay it out? I mean,
well, I was just hammering in crosses with my mallet, what have you. And the Legion sent me all the stuff. And it was quite nice once I had it all laid out. Then on the next day, I would stand in front of the plot, at the head of the plot, and whoever member of the royal family came forward, they would talk to me like, well, I was lucky, they all spoke to me like, you know, it's the last 4 years. Last month being His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the year before Her Majesty the Queen, the year before that Queen Mum, and then the Duke of Kent.
So that's from 1999 onwards, right?
Yeah. So anyway, I discovered last year that I had no need to lay the plot out myself. The British Legion do it. So I liaise with the British Legion and I liaise with the chaps who look after the finances in our regimental association, and they readily agreed that the British Legion should do it. So I went down to Richmond in Surrey with a big blown up photograph of how I'd laid the plot out and told the guy who would like it. And when I went for the first time last November there, last month, to see it, it was terrific. They did a marvellous job. So on that's about the strength of it. On balance, I had a happy time in the army, some great times, some sad times, and some not so good times. But on balance, I'd chosen the right career.
Thank you very much.